Call the meeting to order. We have committee members who are in and out of various committee meetings, and so we're going to start, even though we don't have a quorum, we'll start with our bill today, which is House Bill 1986, and Representative Shumpert, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and move that bill in your committee.
Okay.
And we'll have to wait for until we get the a quorum to be able to put the amendment on, but at least you can move the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1986 for consideration by this committee.
Hey, Representative Shumpert moves that House Bill 1986 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1986 deals with, I think, the most important, perhaps the most important environmental issue in our state today, and that is the level of atrazine in drinking water. And okay, do you all have a copy of the AO7?
The amendment?
Yes.
It's coming. It's being
okay.
It's being copied with the handwritten amendment. So we'll just wait for that.
We did some additions to House File 1986 that you have in front of you. Based on some information we gathered with the help of Dr. John Stein from the Department of Health, and very helpful in refining this bill to reflect exactly what we want to do with it, reconciling the current differences between the health risk limits for private wells and the maximum containment level in public waters for public water systems. We're setting them both at 3 parts per million, and then in the second part, we're going to direct the Department of Health to look at even a lower exposure level over time. And the amendment is being redrafted for members of the committee shortly here. But rather than take any more time about that, I'm very pleased to have one of the, arguably the leading person researching the effects of atrazine on health and on wildlife in this country, and that is Dr. Tyrone Hayes from Berkeley. It just happened that he was here today, and we were able to have this hearing at the same time. So we're really fortunate, and I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Hayes at this time, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Hayes.
Thank you. Shall I start?
Go ahead, sir.
I'd like to start briefly, as I always do when I speak, to give a few quick acknowledgments. First to my family, which I think that's what this issue, this bill, is really all about. So to my wife and kids for their love and support. I also want to acknowledge and disclose all of my funding sources that I've used for studying atrazine, and that includes initial funding from Novartis, Syngenta, the major manufacturer of atrazine, who you'll hear from later. And then I want to acknowledge all of the students that have been involved in my laboratory and research over the last 10 years. I want to first, for the committee, sort of explain why amphibians are an important model for trying to understand the problems related to atrazine. This is a leopard frog. It's one of the test animals that we use in the laboratory. And unlike mammals, which are inside of a mother, which have a placenta, and unlike birds and reptiles, which have eggshells, the eggs of amphibians develop without any protection from the external environment. So while they're going through these critical stages of development, you're watching an egg here through hours of development, and then through their metamorphosis from tadpole to a frog, there are hormones that are critical in regulating the genes that both destroy the tadpole, so to speak, and that also result in the unfolding of the adult form. It turns out that those hormones are exactly the same chemically as the hormones that we use in our own bodies. So the thyroid hormone that regulates our growth and development and neural differentiation is exactly the same thyroid hormone that regulates development in frogs. The testosterone that's necessary for the male's production of sperm and male sex characters is exactly the same testosterone in frogs. And the estrogen that regulates everybody's menstrual cycle, every woman's menstrual cycle in this room, the same estrogen that is involved in stimulating breast cancer is exactly the same estrogen we see in frogs. In addition, not only the hormones are the same, but the genes that they regulate and the way that they regulate those genes are the same. So the things that we discover, the problems that we discover in frogs, as I'll show, are directly related and predictive of problems that you might expect in mammals, including humans. Because there's no eggshell, because there's no placenta, because compounds that interfere with those hormones have direct access to the organism, frogs may be a bit more sensitive than humans. So we're going to get into some discussion, and I'm sure St. Jim's is going to have some discussion about levels and concentrations and how they relate. But as sensitive models, as canaries in the coal mine, if you will, I think frogs are incredibly important for helping us understand what some of the health consequences may be to ourselves. By way of introduction, actually this photo was taken in Minnesota. This is obviously a corn field. Atrazine is primarily used on corn. 85% of the corn acres in this country utilize atrazine. For those who are chemically inclined, this is the structure of atrazine, a so-called S-chlorotriazine. It's an herbicide. So an herbicide or weed killer is a type of pesticide. It's a weed killer primarily used on corn. It's been used for 48 years. So for 48 years, it's estimated that 60% of all Americans have been exposed to atrazine. And we use 80 million pounds annually in the United States. Until recently, it was the number one selling pesticide in the world. It's now tied or has been surpassed by glyphosate. Doesn't mean that we're using less atrazine, just means now we're using an equal amount of glyphosate or Roundup. And it's used in more than 80 countries. And at this point, it's now outlawed in all of Europe. I periodically get legal-sounding letters from Syngenta, and one of them says that this is a misrepresentation. It has not been outlawed in Europe. The language I guess they would like me to use is it has been denied regulatory approval in Europe. But the reason that this is significant is because Novartis Syngenta is home base. It's in Switzerland. So here we're using 80 million pounds of a compound that's not allowed in the home country. I'm going to tell you briefly about our frog data before I talk to you about some of the public health implications. We published some time ago in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we published a paper showing, and this originated with work that was funded by Novartis Syngenta, we published work showing the following. What you're looking at is a kidney and gonads from one of our lab models, from the African frog, that's been exposed to 0.1 parts per billion atrazine. This animal has two testes, two ovaries, a large testes, and more ovaries. It is a hermaphrodite, and unlike you may have heard from some of the Syngenta-funded representatives, this is not a natural aspect of development. Frogs are not hermaphrodites naturally. It does not occur unless they suffer assault from some chemical such as atrazine or added estrogen. We now know, though, that this is a genetic male that's produced ovaries in addition to its testes. The reason that we believe this happens, and we now have evidence, and I'll show you as well in human cell lines, is that normally, whether you're frog or human, you should make testosterone from your testes, which literally means hormone of the testis. That's where the name comes from. With exposure to atrazine, again, in amphibians as low as 0.1 parts per billion, the gene for the enzyme aromatase comes on. So it's the machinery, if you will, for converting testosterone into estrogen is turned on by atrazine. There are two results if you're a frog, and we'll talk about the results in humans. One is you are chemically castrated or demasculinized because you're using up your testosterone to make estrogen. And there are other mechanisms by which atrazine reduces testosterone as well. Secondarily, you're feminized if you're a male frog because now you're making estrogen, which literally means the generator of estrus, when you should be making testosterone. So it's a hormone imbalance, if you will. Now, as a scientist, or as anybody, you might argue, well, that's one species. You know, we've replicated it dozens of times in my laboratory, but you still might argue that's one species. What does it really mean for amphibians? So we took what we learned from this laboratory model and we did comparative studies. So we studied the northern leopard frog, which I showed you earlier. This is a genetic male that's been exposed to 0.1 parts per billion atrazine. This work was published in Nature and was published by the National Institutes of Health and their Environmental Health Perspectives Journal. And these are testes from this male, but all of the structure in the back of each one of these testes, those are all eggs. Those are all eggs that are, not only has this male produced eggs instead of sperm, but this male has yolked those eggs, and they're now bursting through the surface of this male's testes. So again, this is work that has all been peer-reviewed and published, and it's available to anybody who would like to look at the original data. Secondly, you might ask, well, so we did it in two species, and actually it's been done in four species in the laboratory, some published by other laboratories as well. You might argue, what does this mean for the real world? So we took what we learned in the laboratory, and we went into the field and asked, do we see hermaphrodites or animals with these abnormalities in the field. Before I go into the field data, I'd like to speak briefly about what 0.1 parts per billion means. And I'm very happy about your bill that's coming up, because it means that you will only be tenfold higher than the effective dose if you get it down to one part per billion. Point one part per billion, what I usually say, because I'm a visual person. So if you're like me, it means nothing. You can't see 0.1 parts per billion or 0.1 micrograms per liter. But imagine 1/1000th of a grain of salt. 1/1000th of a grain of salt in 4 liters. That's what we're talking about. 1/1000th of a grain of salt. And now, some of the critics will tell you, well, that's too low. And it is too low to be toxic. But it's not too low to be an endocrine disruptor. Hormones, for example, estrogens, work at 1,000 times lower than this. They work in the picogram per mil, which is nanograms per liter, not micrograms per liter. So this is, for endocrinologists, somebody who studies hormones, this is a high level. This is a high dose. Now, next thing I want to point out is that if you do the calculation, the application rate of atrazine is 2.9 to 29 million parts per billion. So it's applied at levels that would be 290 million times what it takes to chemically castrate and produce hermaphroditic frog. We went through the published literature and we looked at minimum and maximum detectable levels of atrazine in agricultural runoff, temporary pools, permanent water such as lakes and rivers, and precipitation. This line is now showing you the 0.1 parts per billion that chemically castrates and produces hermaphroditic frogs, and this red overlay is now showing you all of the habitats that would be at risk based on our laboratory and field data. There's enough atrazine in rainwater to chemically castrate and produce hermaphroditic frogs. I learned here in Minnesota that Perry Jones with the U.S. Geological Survey has shown that when they apply atrazine in Kansas, it comes down in the rainwater in Minnesota. A 500,000 pounds of atrazine are reported in the rainwater in the United States every year. They've shown the same thing in Europe, that when France restricts the use of atrazine, it didn't matter because it came over from neighboring countries, which is why the European Union voted as a group that they had to get rid of atrazine in all of the Union. This is the current EPA safe level in 3 parts per billion, which was just discussed here, is the EPA's drinking water standard. I know you can do the math, but the drinking water standard is set at 30 times what we know to be effective dose in frogs. And again, as I usually point out, when this 3 parts per billion was set, it wasn't because the EPA, in fact, I was at a meeting last week where an EPA official said, the problem is people misunderstand the EPA. This is a quote. They said, if the EPA approves a chemical, it's not because it's safe. It's because we've evaluated the risk. That was out of the mouth of somebody from the EPA. The drinking water standard at 3 parts per billion wasn't set because anybody showed that 3 parts per billion was safe. The drinking water standard at 3 parts per billion was because they studied a rat and showed that above 3,000 parts per billion, these rats developed pituitary tumors. They divided by 10 because they only used one strain of rat and other strains might be more sensitive. They divided by 10 because they only used rats and other species might be more sensitive. And they divided by 10 just because there's some uncertainty factor and it might be something that they don't know. Nobody ever tested 3 parts per billion. And pardon the violence, but I use the analogy of, it's like if I shot you with one of these armor-piercing grenade rocket launchers and then tried to convince you that handguns are safe just because they're smaller. That's how the safety limit was set with atrazine. It's 1,000 times smaller than another effect that they identified. So knowing that, what the 0.1 parts per billion levels really mean, we went out and we tested animals in the field, and this is work published by Nature and peer-reviewed by Environmental Health Perspectives, NIH. And this is an animal from the field. These are kidneys. These are gonads. And I'm going to show you a histological cross-section. So imagine that I'm slicing a salami really thin, 1/1000th of a millimeter thin. I'm folding that section out for you. Here's what it looks like under the microscope. And the color's different because of the stain we use under the microscope. What you see if you look inside this male testis is here's a testicular tubule. Can you guys see the arrow that I'm using as a pointer? Here's a testicular tubule, just like we have. Here are the nerve cells, or the Sertoli cells that are inside the testicular tubule. But instead of nursing sperm, these structures are eggs that are developing inside of this male's testis collected from the wild. Again, we showed across the United States that we could match up hermaphrodites with where we found atrazine contamination, 100% of the time. We're now doing a much larger study where we're looking at sites to expand it all over the United States. In fact, the U.S. Geological Survey has been involved, and they've sent me some of the worst hermaphrodites I've ever seen from the Mississippi River in Minnesota. And again, that work is still ongoing. The original work has been published and peer-reviewed in one of our top journals. Lastly, before I move on, I'm going to tell you very briefly about what I call field simulations, because we have these studies that were controlled in the laboratory, but not real because they're in the lab. We have this real study out in the wild that's real, but it's not controlled. We have no control over when and where atrazine is applied. But lastly, we went out into the field and we tried to bring the field into the laboratory, so to speak. And our approach there was to look at an area like this one in Nebraska, to go to a site where we're collecting hermaphrodites, such as the one they're showing in the arrows, and to look at what's really happening at the site shown here. It turns out that the frogs in this pond are not just exposed to atrazine in the wild, they're exposed to a whole host of herbicides shown in red, fungicides shown in blue, and insecticides shown in purple. We tested each one of those individual chemicals because even though atrazine did it in the laboratory, and even though atrazine was associated with the problem in the field, maybe some of these other chemicals might be contributing to the hermaphroditism. Turns out that none of these other chemicals will produce the sexual effects that we identified for atrazine, but there were enhancing effects, if you will, of the other chemicals. Of note, if you look at blood levels of corticosterone, the stress hormone in frogs, what you'll find is that atrazine, and this is known in rodents as well, is that atrazine and these other chemicals will induce a stress response. So in addition to causing sexual problems in the frogs, they have higher levels of stress hormones, and those stress hormones are associated with immunosuppression, and again, there's data in rodents that I'll tell you about as well, decreased growth, retarded development, and inhibited metamorphosis. We've proposed and now shown in peer-reviewed journals published by the National Institutes of Health that when you start adding pesticides along with atrazine, you increase the stress response more and more. So in addition to frogs becoming sexually malformed, they show a slow rate of metamorphosis, retarded development. They show decreased growth, and I'll show you what that looks like in the real world. And they show disease problems. Some of those diseases in the laboratory include flavobacterial meningitis. Others of those diseases in the field, this is a frog collected from Nebraska. Here's the liver. And under the microscope, what you'll notice is that liver, those white nodules, are all cestodes that are filled up in this animal's liver. If you look at their kidneys under the microscope, here's one kidney. There are very few tubules. They suffer from parasite loads, trematodes, that damage their kidneys. So they become unable even to get rid of the pesticides because they suffer this liver and kidney damage that's a result of the stress hormones that cause them to get these large parasite loads. It's not just us. Other people have shown, for example, Joe Kiesinger published a peer-reviewed paper, again, published by the National Institutes of Health, where he showed that even though atrazine doesn't cause limb deformities, which I'm sure you know about in Minnesota, atrazine lowers immune function in these frogs, so they get more of the parasites that then cause the limb deformities. Another paper just came out in 2006 that showed that atrazine, this is the title of the paper, atrazine increases rhinovirus susceptibility in the tiger salamanders. So what I want you to understand from this all is that we're not just talking about laboratory artifacts. We're not just talking about one person's studies. There are multiple laboratories looking at these effects. We're not just talking about one effect that impairs these animals' health. We're talking about sex problems, sexual development problems. We're talking about problems with growth. We're talking about immunosuppression. And so if I'm an ecologist trying to evaluate the role of atrazine in the environment, it's difficult. Because if I'm looking at amphibian declines and trying to find the causes, I don't see dead frogs from toxicity. I see frogs that had retarded development. I see frogs that couldn't find enough food because they suffered from decreased growth, and I'll show you what that looks like. I see frogs that are more likely eaten because they're small and or deformed. I see frogs that are suffering from what we think are new emergent diseases. But in fact, underlying that all, interacting, are pesticides that are making these amphibians more vulnerable to these effects. Now, one of the things that tangential will tell you, I was just on a radio show, and Alex Avery, critic of the work, came on and said, you haven't shown a population decline due to atrazine. And what I want you to think about is the following. And I get in this argument with the EPA as well. Do I have to show that amphibians are disappearing directly because of atrazine to show that the effect is real and important? And I ask you for this reason. I'm sure everybody in this room understands that in humans, for example, HIV is a big problem. I'm sure everybody in this room understands that breast cancer and prostate cancer are big problems, and that the incidences of these diseases are increasing in the human population. Has the human population declined because of these diseases? Still growing. So just because you don't see the numbers, I don't think the human population has declined because of a disease like the Black Plague. So just because you don't see a population decline doesn't mean there's not a real problem. And I want you to keep that in mind. The next question, and from here I'm going to move away from frogs, is how do we show that this is a real-life effect in the wild? And we did that by running what I call my lab field lab model backwards. We recently, and this is now unpublished, so it has not been peer-reviewed yet, we started working along the Salinas River, where I might point out 85% of the U.S. is lettuce and 14% of the United States' produce comes upstream here in Salinas, in the Salinas Valley. When we look upstream of agriculture, we find water, a river water that's 2 feet deep, 22 degrees. That's a nice place to be if you're a frog. If we go downstream, just about 50 miles or so, the river still looks fine. In fact, it's dried out down here. The river's still 22 degrees, you know, still 2 feet deep, not a very threatening environment. The difference is, down here, all of this water is agricultural runoff. So this area of the river is actually dry. All this water that repopulates, if you will, the river, all that water comes from your food. And there's atrazine use there as well, among other chemicals. So to show you the real impact in the real world, we took the laboratory to the field. We made some predictions based on our laboratory studies that these animals would show retarded development. So this is like gestational age, if you will. Downstream of agriculture, same population. You see the retarded development. If you look at the growth, you see that the growth is retarded, just like our laboratory data would predict. And just to show you what that looked like, these two tadpoles, which are from an endangered species, by the way, are exactly the same gestational age, if you will. The only difference is, this one's living downstream of the runoff from your food. So there's a real-world impact. To test for the immunosuppression, we caged individual animals, and I usually make this joke, we injected them with a deadly pathogen. That pathogen was bread yeast. Just simple bread yeast. In Santa Margarita, before you get to the agricultural area, they're fine. At the other site, at the two highest doses of yeast, animals are paralyzed, and then the hatch bars and red bars show you morbidity and mortality. So you don't need a fancy new emergent disease like chytrid to kill off frogs. All you need is pesticide exposure to cause immunosuppression, and then something as simple as bread yeast. And this death occurred within 12 hours, by the way. I usually make this reference when I speak to general audiences about my crossing the line. Because I get many talks here in Minnesota where people finally started saying to me, well, Tyrone, you gave half a talk. And they would say that because I've been trained as a scientist. My advisor, who I love, by the way, when I first got involved in this, said, Tyrone, don't be an advocate. Let the science speak for itself. Because as academics, we aren't supposed to get involved in policy and public things, so to speak. But several things have moved me to cross that line. I'm very happy you want to move it down to one part per billion. My opinion, my professional and personal opinion, is that you should get rid of it. The reason I cross the line is the science doesn't always speak for itself. Sherry Ford of Syngenta, for example, has said things like, research that we have funded does not support the conclusions that Hayes is drawing from his own research. Turns out that's not true. I've been told it's unprofessional to use the word lie, but it turns out that's just simply not true. Jim Carr, the scientist who did the work that they're talking about, wrote, was reported in a newspaper saying, I don't think our data contradicts Hayes. My research speaks for itself. I am not responsible for how Syngenta chooses to characterize it. And in fact, if you look at his work, here's my hermaphrodite, here's his hermaphrodite, the arrows are showing the frequencies of gonadal abnormalities and hermaphrodites that he produced and his publication. At some doses, he got more hermaphrodites than we did. That's one of the things that moved me to really cross that line and advocate. Another one was recently, and this one's going to become important, I'll show you the full quote at the end. On December 3rd, Stephen Bradbury was reported in the newspaper saying the ultimate decision regarding atrazine is much bigger than science. This is the EPA. I've often entitled this talk From Silent Spring to Silent Night in reference to Rachel Carson's warning that the silent spring or the death of birds due to pesticides indicated pending danger for us. And I think the impact that we're seeing on frogs similarly our warning that we should pay attention to. I think it's ironic that in Uganda, where the runoff from this crop, which goes into these containers, which is their sole source of drinking and bathing water, I think it's ironic that these men would clearly understand the dangers if, for example, they were immunosuppressed frogs with eggs and their testes in that water, because there's a direct connection between environmental health and public health when you live that way. I always joke, here's my village. When you live the way we live, we have this false sense of security. When in fact, my house is here, my water just comes from there. And with a 500,000 pounds of atrazine and potentially other chemicals coming down in the rainwater, with an EPA standard that's 30 times higher than the biologically effective dose, we really aren't in much better shape than those guys in Uganda. It's just that we think that we're protected. A colleague of mine, Glenn Fox, wrote, in eco-epidemiology, the occurrence of an association in more than one species and species population is very strong evidence for causation. What I want to tell you is that we haven't just shown these effects in one species of frog. We've shown it in multiple species of frog. It's not just lab data. It's also data from the wild. But more importantly, if that is the strong evidence for causation, the effects of atrazine have been shown in fish, similar effects. They've been shown in reptiles and birds. Other labs, all published, there were 40 papers, and I won't have time to talk about it, but I will talk to you about the effects in mammals. The EPA reported here 2 years ago, Ann Lindsay said, there's no direct scientific information to assess this hypothesis. In fact, there's over 40 published papers. I now have a website where you can get direct access to those papers, which I'll tell you about in the end. I'm just going to show you very briefly that atrazine reduces testosterone and an associated reduction in sperm production in mammals. In rats, a study published in Europe showed that there's not only a decline in testosterone in exposed rats, but there's a decline in sperm number. So this isn't my work. Shauna Swan showed that if you compare atrazine levels in the urine of men from Columbia, Missouri, and men who report that they're subfertile, low sperm count, and they have trouble getting their wives pregnant, there's significantly more, there's the p-value if you care, there's significantly more atrazine in those men's urine. Now, I don't know what it means. You're probably going to hear that the doses in mammals are so different from the doses in frogs and you can't compare. Nobody knows how to compare them. In rats, we're going to be talking about milligrams per kilogram. In frogs, we're talking about parts per billion. Nobody knows when you feed a rat atrazine how much ends up in the blood, how much ends up in the urine, but we do know that they're effects, and we do know that they're correlated effects in humans. Again, I don't know what it means, but these men who have low sperm count have 0.1 parts per billion in their urine. These men have enough atrazine in their urine to chemically castrate a frog. Now, watch the y-axis, because I'm going to show you some other people's data. So the data's still here. Just now the axis goes up at 240. Lucas et al. Showed that here atrazine levels in the urine of men who work in the fields, the first set of data was just men who live in Columbia, Missouri, and the axis has changed again because here the atrazine levels, 2,400 for atrazine applicators. These men have 24,000 times the atrazine in their urine than is associated with low fertility in men in Columbia, Missouri. These men have 24,000 times the atrazine in their urine that it takes to chemically castrate and make a hermaphroditic frog. Again, I don't know what it means for these men. Nobody does. Because these are primarily the Mexican migrant farm workers and nobody follows their healthcare at all. And I don't know what it means, but I do know that one of these men could pee in a bucket. I could dilute it 24,000 times. And I could chemically castrate and produce hermaphroditic frogs in 24,000 buckets of 30 tadpoles each. The other half of the story is that atrazine turns on aromatase and causes the inappropriate production of estrogen, which leads to yolk and egg production in frogs and fish, males, but also leads to mammary tumors in humans and in laboratory rodents. If we look at blood levels of testosterone in rats, and this is published by an EPA laboratory, testosterone goes down and estrogens go up, just like we see in frogs, just like you see in fish, just like they see in alligators and turtles. And since just a funded laboratory even showed that there's an increase in the incidence of breast tumors in rats exposed to atrazine. Now, they're probably going to tell you that there was no increase in the incidence. Because if you read the paper, what they say is, well, the level of tumors that the atrazine-exposed rats got was no different from a control if it was allowed to get old enough. In other words, they're saying, well, the rats got cancer, but not at a higher incidence. It just happened earlier. That's like saying, well, you're going to die anyway. We're just going to make it happen a little bit earlier. If you look at humans, it was shown in a human cell line that the gene for aromatase, which makes estrogen, It's turned on in human cell lines. We just published two papers just this last month showing that the sequence of the gene in frogs is exactly the same as the sequence in humans, and we use human cancer cell lines to completely unravel the molecular mechanism by which atrazine turns on this gene. And in those cell lines, it turns it on at about a part per billion. There's a study, at least one study, by Kettles et al. In Kentucky that showed that women whose well water is contaminated with atrazine are more likely to get breast tumors with a p-value of 0.0001. That means that there's only a 0.01% chance that this association is random. 1/100th a penny out of a dollar. And prostate cancer. In one of Syngenta's own factories, workers exposed to atrazine had an 8.4-fold higher incidence of prostate cancer. Now, Syngenta claims it's because they monitor their workers better than the general public. But these data are compared to men who work in the factory but just don't bag and get exposed to atrazine. So everybody that I'm showing you in this graph was monitored by Syngenta. So the evidence is there for mammals. I don't know where the statement from the EPA, there is no direct scientific information to assess this hypothesis. I don't know where that comes from. There's over 40 papers looking at that. And even though we're talking about frogs where we can do the experimental work, which you can't do in humans, you can do it in rats and frogs, but you can't do it in humans, the genes are the same. So in the same way that we can use development in frogs to tell us something about humans, we can use humans, what I call this other aquatic organism, we can use those cell lines to tell us things about frogs that, because we don't have the cell lines from the frogs. I want to take one brief minute now, because the other thing you're going to hear, or the other thing I've heard from Syngenta-funded groups is, well, you can't compare rats to humans. And the data in rats aren't necessarily telling us anything about humans. I want to take a minute to talk to you about something other than atrazine. You guys have probably heard of DES. It was an estrogen that was given to pregnant women that caused the daughters of those pregnant women to develop uterine malformations and cervical and vaginal cancer. We discovered that problem in humans by looking at rats. But now I want you to learn several lessons from rats exposed to DES. One is, one part per billion causes obesity. Right? So this fat rat, sorry about the rhyme, this fat rat here has the same caloric intake, the same exercise, everything's the same except it's exposed to DES. Number two, 100 part per billion DES actually causes you to lose weight. I'll tell you what the real lessons are in a minute. The other one is, if those DES exposed rats have daughters, they get vaginal cancer and uterine deformities. When those rats grow up, they still have the uterine deformities and the vaginal cancers. So three, the offspring develop reproductive cancers and malformations. And then finally, we showed in the laboratory that the granddaughters of the exposed rats will develop those same uterine and vaginal cancers. This isn't rats. Here are the points I want you to know, so they're going to change. Number one is, low doses matter. Number two is high doses do not predict the low dose effect. So atrazine's toxicity on the high end doesn't tell you what it's going to do on the low end. Number three is that one compound can have many effects. It induces obesity in the exposed rat, but it induces cancer in that rat's daughters. And number four, the early exposure is important and the effects can cross generations. The fifth thing I want you to learn is that we learned this first in rats. We now know, my generation is the generation whose mothers were exposed to DES. I now have colleagues, women, who are having babies with those same malformations, and they haven't been exposed since their grandmother. We knew this first in rats. What if we'd had to wait two generations? And the only reason we could figure this out for DES, because it was a prescription drug. And we could trace back from those granddaughters that their grandmothers were exposed. There is no such data will ever exist for you to trace back who was exposed to atrazine. With that in mind, I want to point out, I talked to you about prostate and mammary cancer induced by atrazine. I didn't have time to talk about it, but atrazine, just like it does in frogs, causes immune failure. Animals are more susceptible to disease. And developmentally, when young rodents are exposed, they experience neural damage that causes them to lose brain cells so that they can't learn and they are hyperactive. All published literature, over 60 papers, which you can get from my website. Atrazine also in some strains of rats induces abortion. Of those rats that can deliver, the pups of an exposed mother can develop prostate disease. The pups of an exposed mother, an EPA lab showed that the daughters of the exposed mother have impaired mammary development, and here's what that looks like. So normally there are all these branching buds that will produce the milk in a normal rat, and the daughters of exposed rats, they hardly have any ducts to produce milk. As a result, when they grow up, their daughters show impaired growth and development. So the granddaughters of an exposed rat see the effect of that exposure. We've already played this game with DES. Do the rat data really tell us anything about humans? What's the expression? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. We've already played the game with DES. Are we going to wait two generations to find out if the rat data are telling us something about humans? The other thing that the company's going to tell you is that work in cell lines doesn't tell you about the true effects in humans. But in fact, that's how we do all of our drug discovery. Let me give you an example. Cancer is a damaged cell. When you damage a breast cell, aromatase is induced around that cell, produces estrogen, and it's the estrogen that causes 70% of breast cancers to grow. Even if we accept what the EPA said, that, well, we don't know enough about these data, here's how much we know about the role of aromatase. There are companies right now producing compounds that reduce aromatase, reduce estrogen, and stop breast cancer from growing. In fact, this company that produces letrozole, which blocks aromatase, says on their website that letrozole is 1,000 times better than the best breast cancer treatment there is. 1,000 times better at treating the number one cancer in women and the number one cause of death in cancer. At the same time, we're exposing 1 million people a day, 60% of all Americans, to a compound that does the opposite of letrozole. And here's the kicker. Not a different company. Novartis, who gave us 50 years of atrazine and who will tell you on one site that the induction of aromatase is irrelevant to cancer, is now trying to sell you a drug that blocks aromatase, where they're saying, oh, it's 1,000 times better at treating cancer. They both can't be true. If a compound that induces, that blocks aromatase, is the best treatment for breast cancer, how can a compound that turns on aromatase be okay for us? I want to just move forward a bit because I see that my time's coming up. And I want to remind you again, I want to talk about the EPA. If you're waiting on the EPA to make this decision for you, here's what the EPA has decided for atrazine. That first, we have to take a working hypothesis and test it. The company was given 6 years to do what it takes my laboratory 3 months to do. Even if we get a no answer there then, they have to address the ecological relevance. So they have to repeat the studies that we've already done in the wild. Even if they get that, then the EPA is requiring that they completely understand the mechanism before we even talk about regulation. Now, people have accused me of having something against Syngenta and atrazine, so let's forget about Syngenta and atrazine for a minute. We banned DDT in 1973. If this model had been around with the EPA, we would have had 7 more years of DDT because we didn't have the laboratory evidence to show eggshell thinning until 1980. If the EPA's model had been around, we would have had 25 more years of DDT because it wasn't until 1998 that we had the field studies to show that when you remove DDT, eggshell thinning returned to normal. And in 2006, a paper was published that showed, first line of the paper was, the mechanism for contaminant-induced eggshell thinning in wild birds remains to be clarified. So if the EPA's model that they're going to use for atrazine had been around in 1973, DDT would still be on the market. We don't understand how DES gets transferred to granddaughters. It would still be on the market. Everything we banned would be back on the market. Now, what we need is a truly protective policy. If kids are getting hit by cars, you don't keep testing it to see why. You put a stop to it. You put a stop to it until you show that it wasn't the real cause. Now, the other reason that I'm here and I've crossed the line is the EPA's second part of that statement was the ultimate decision is much bigger than science. It weighs in public opinion. They're counting on you. The EPA, in my opinion, they're giving you the power to make the decision. They're saying, we're not going to do it. We're not going to look at the science. Public opinion matters. And that's why I've crossed that line to bring you the information that you need, that I believe you need, to make an informed decision. Now, I'm going to skip through this because I don't want to take away from Syngenta's time. All I want to point out here is that if you look at, because economic issues and issues of feeding people are going to come up, all this is pointing out is that we only eat 2% of the corn that we grow. Atrazine increases corn yield by 1.2%. We're going to gamble our granddaughter's granddaughters on a 1.2% increase in a crop that we only eat 2% of, when 20% of the world will die of starvation. Those are the costs and benefits I want you to think of, and I want you to think about the following as I close here, that the benefits of atrazine, the extra money that we get for the extra corn that we're not eating, go to one set of people, but those who suffer the costs are a different set of people. This is a map that just gives a whole new meaning to the term red states, but this is a map of the atrazine use that I got from the U.S. Geological Survey, and I'm here really to talk about with this talk on the Mississippi River. If you follow the Mississippi River from Minnesota, you're best off, because it's the cleanest here. It's still not clean. You can see all the red. But these field workers and applicators with the 24,000 parts per billion atrazine, they can't vote for you. These migrant Mexican farmers. I'm not going to tell you why, but you know. They can't vote for you. So the decision that you make will have the biggest impact on people who can't be in this room. If we go a little further down the Mississippi to Missouri, these are the men with the subfertility. They're not only dealing with the atrazine that they're using in Missouri, but they're dealing with the atrazine that you put in the Mississippi that goes down to them. They can't vote for you because they don't live in Minnesota. If we go a little further down, I was just down in Baton Rouge where the Syngenta factory is. This is what parts of the Mississippi River look like there. This is the back of Syngenta's atrazine factory where their wastewater goes directly into the Mississippi River. And these are the men in their factory which have an 8.4-fold increase in prostate cancer. The town of St. Gabriel where this is 80% African-American, 80% black, and blacks are already four times more likely to die from prostate cancer. They can't vote for you. In fact, this is much bigger than Minnesota. It's much bigger than the United States. The EPA has given you the power and really put the world in your hands, most of whom can't vote for you. In fact, I would argue that none of the people who really benefit from what you're going to do here in Minnesota to start it off, it has to happen all over the country. I would argue that most of the people, none of the people who will vote for you will benefit from this, because this is not about me and you. We've already been exposed. This is not about our children. Our children have already been exposed. And given that France has shown that when they stop using atrazine, it's going to hang around for 20 years, our grandchildren have already been exposed. The people who will benefit from your decisions can't vote for you because they haven't been born yet. And the reason I crossed that line, the reason I'm here, is because I have this dream that one day our grandchildren's grandchildren will be sitting around talking. And they'll be having a discussion about how their great-great-great-grandfather, grandmother voted. How their great-great-great-grandfather, whether they considered a 1.2% increase in corn, and some studies say there's no increase at all. I know what I want my great-great-great-granddaughter to say about the role that I played in this revolution and how we regulate chemicals in this country and hopefully the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. Thank you. Before we go to... We're going to have one more witness, and then we'll have time for a discussion with everyone. But now that we have a quorum, I know that you, Representative Shepard, wanted to amend your bill, and let's have you do that officially first.
Okay.
I think that amendment...
has been handed out.
Has been handed out. While we're waiting for that to happen, let me welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. Why don't you stand and be recognized? Welcome to this committee. See, some of what we're talking about today affects you, right? Okay.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Shumper moves the amendment entitled A070489.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just had one correction to make there. I conferred this morning with Dr. Stein from Health, or actually yesterday as well, and we were working out the language on this, and I think you have a handwritten in, and there was one word I wanted to change there. Use current scientific evidence to evaluate. I wanted to substitute the word set for evaluate.
So on line 1.9, you want to strike evaluate and...
And substitute the word set.
Does everybody have that? Okay, this puts the bill in the form that Representative Shumper wants. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Looks like the minute is before us. And I think what we'll do right now is ask Dr. Hayes to stand by, and we'll hear from the opposition, and then we'll have a chance to talk to both of them.
Just a parliamentary question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I didn't hear where the bill is going.
Oh, okay. We talked about it earlier. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
And Madam Chair, at what point do you want to address the thoughts about where the bill is going? Would you rather do that later?
We can do it later when we vote if you have a question about it, sure. Okay. So, you can just hold on. We want to make sure that we get our other testimony in. And I would like to invite Mr. Pastor. Wanted to come and provide some information to the committee. And then we'll come back and we'll have a chance to question both witnesses in our office. Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and the audience here of the Minnesota citizens who do in fact have a right and opportunity to think about some of these things.
Could you just introduce yourself, please?
I'm representing Syngenta Crop Protection, and my name is Timothy Pastor. I have a PhD in toxicology from the University of Michigan. I'm certified by the American Board of Toxicology, and I'm the head of human safety for Syngenta, and I've got a lot of history with atrazine in the testing of this compound and the re-registration of this compound, which EPA did in 2006, based on over 6,000 studies that were done on this very valuable product to the Minnesota farmer. 6,000 studies, that's a mammoth amount of studies that have been done, and evaluated over 12 years in a special review process that was put together by EPA to make sure that there weren't being decisions made that were done off the cuff based on poor evidence, but based on sound science. So what I'm going to do here is present Syngenta's side of the story. And you've heard a lot of very scary statements here by Dr. Hayes, and they will get your attention, I can assure you. But I can also assure you that based on the 6,000 studies, tremendous amount of effort that's been put in by independent scientists, not Syngenta's scientists, independent scientists from around the world that have looked at the evidence, have given EPA the opportunity to evaluate the data and re-register atrazine, again, as a valuable product in the Minnesota farming community. I'm not going to take up much of your time this morning, and I'm not going to show you pretty slides, and I'm not going to try and scare you. I'm just going to try and tell you a few things about atrazine. And to do that, what I'm going to do is talk first about what the EPA process is for looking at the evidence. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the human and environmental health, just make a couple statements about that. I'm also going to mention some things about water and what the actual amounts are when they are there. I'm going to talk a little bit about the benefits. Let me start out, first of all, that 2 years ago, on February the 16th, Ms. Ann Lindsay from EPA, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Pesticide Programs, was here testifying in this chair to a different committee. But she presented testimony at that point in time that was read into the record. And what she was trying to present to people is the following issue that I think is absolutely instrumental to this entire issue. Dr. Hayes has an opinion. Syngenta has an opinion. We base it on science. How are you going to make sense of that? You see scary pictures. You see Syngenta saying one thing, Dr. Hayes saying another. Who's going to be the arbitrator in this process? And that arbitrator is really EPA. They've got to look at all the issues and make a decision. To do that, they base it on sound science and a transparent public evaluation of all the scientific information to make those decisions. It's a very important part of it, and as Ann Lindsay says in her testimony that she brings forward, EPA reaches its conclusions through a systematic, objective evaluation of all relevant information. Each step of the process uses scientifically peer-reviewed, documented procedures. And it relies on good laboratory practices, an open and honest exchange of information, and in the process of doing that can come to an honest conclusion about what is good or what is bad and what should be done with atrazine, which was re-registered in 2006 by the EPA. Part of that process that EPA uses is a scientific advisory panel mechanism. By doing that, what EPA says is we're going to bring in academic scientists from all over the world. They're not Syngenta. They're from institutions across the world. And we're going to lay out all the information. They're going to be able to look at the raw data when it's available and take a look and see what's there. There have been three of those on atrazine so far. One in the year 2000 concluded that atrazine is not going to cause cancer in humans. That's documented. That's out there. The World Health Organization has also declared that atrazine is not likely to cause cancer in humans. The Australian Health Board has also made that same declaration. Furthermore, in a study that's huge that was done by the government called the Agricultural Health Study, looking at farmers and farm families in both North Carolina and Iowa, has shown absolutely no correlation whatsoever between atrazine exposure and the incidence of cancer. So that was the SAP in the year 2000. This is not new information, and we're not waiting for more information to make these kinds of decisions. This is something EPA has looked at over a long period of time, 12 years of special review, and has come to the conclusion that it can re-register atrazine, 2006. In 2003, there were two more scientific advisory panels, again, convened by EPA with experts from around the world to take a look at the epidemiological evidence, which I just mentioned, and also the evidence that was being brought forward on amphibian health. In the epidemiology discussions, EPA concluded that a role for atrazine seems very unlikely in this situation. Furthermore, they looked at what Dr. Hayes has misrepresented as a higher incidence of prostate cancer in the San Gabriel manufacturing plant as being related to atrazine. That wasn't the conclusion of the EPA. In fact, these Syngenta employees have an excellent medical plan that involves digital rectal examinations, prostate-specific antigen examinations as well. And these individuals who had an excellent medical plan and health evaluations were being compared against the Louisiana rural community in that area who don't have that medical surveillance. That's why you detect prostate cancer at a higher level in these individuals. So this is a misrepresentation, and it angers me to hear that. And Dr. Hayes misrepresents that kind of effort and the conclusion by EPA that there's no correlation there. Let me end on human health by saying that in the April 2006 registration eligibility decision that EPA published, EPA granted the re-registration of atrazine and said, and I quote, "The agency has found that there is a reasonable certainty that no harm will result to the general U.S. population, infants, children, or other major identifiable subgroups of consumers from exposure from food, drinking water, and non-occupational sources to atrazine. With that finding and the earlier findings contained in the 2003 scientific advisory panels and the interim re-registration document for atrazine, the agency has now completed its task of determining whether products containing atrazine are eligible for re-registration and granted the re-registration of atrazine. This is based on 12 years of special review and a lot of hard work by people outside of Syngenta. Again, I bring this forward as the EPA process. They're not relying exclusively on Syngenta, and they're not relying exclusively on Dr. Hayes or anyone else. They're taking a look at all of the information and making their conclusions. Let me turn to water. Despite the continued use of atrazine at levels over the last number of years that have been fairly consistent, For reasons that are pretty obvious to the Minnesota farmer, atrazine is an extremely effective compound that they use as a chemical tool. Despite that, there has been a decrease in the concentrations of atrazine in groundwater from extremely low levels of about 0.2 parts per billion, which is extraordinarily low, as Dr. Hayes has pointed out, to non-detectable levels over the last 10 years or so. Those levels are infinitesimally small, getting smaller to the point of non-detectability. This is despite the continued use of atrazine. Well, why is that? There's a reason for that, and that's because the Minnesota farmer wants to make sure that they've got this cheap and reliable compound available to them. They're using best management practices in concert with the excellent efforts of the Department of Agriculture here in the state of Minnesota to make sure that they can use this compound. It's valuable to them. Finally, let me end on what the benefits are. And I've alluded to that, what the Minnesota farmer sees in atrazine. It's inexpensive, and it works. It's contained in over 41 different types of products beyond what Syngenta manufactures. These are other products that work better because atrazine is there. It works. It's cheap. It helps the farmer. And even more important, it's involved instrumentally in conservation tillage to help prevent erosion. The use of these products can prevent 90% of the erosion that would otherwise occur. It's a huge environmental issue and has tremendous impacts on amphibian health to prevent runoff and erosion. Now, let me conclude that the science doesn't justify taking away atrazine from the Minnesota farmer. In fact, it supports the ongoing use of this valuable agricultural tool for Minnesota farmers, and I want to make sure that you hear that from the farmers themselves. Is it valuable to us? Yes. Is it valuable to the Minnesota farmer? Definitely so, without question. And with that, I'll end my brief comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fisker. Okay. Committee members, we're going to take...
Sorry, Madam Chair. I don't understand all the rules of order, but can I address one point?
You can actually both respond. Dr. Hayes, what do you think about that testimony? I'll ask you directly. Do you have some questions or comments about it?
The main thing I want to point out is there's no misrepresentation here. The data that I'm showing you here from the St. Gabriel factory is pulled exactly from their paper. So the data that is shown here that I pulled from their paper shows the percentage in black of men who don't have prostate cancer and a percentage who do, and it's comparing men who work who are exposed to atrazine in the factory compared to men in the factory who were not exposed. These data are straight out of the paper. You can read your own papers. And the exposed males, it said specifically in the paper, all of the men who developed prostate cancer worked in the factory bagging atrazine prior to the installation of a ventilation system that lowered the atrazine levels. It's stated clearly in the paper. So I haven't misrepresented. I just represented in graphic form numbers that came straight out of your publication.
It's a well-established scientific fact. It's a well-established scientific fact, and you know this, that early detection through PSA screening and digital rectal exam is going to detect prostate cancer sooner and more effectively than if you don't do that. And in the individuals who they're being compared to did not have that level of comparison. And that is the truth, and that is the conclusion by Dr. Jerry Blondell from the EPA.
But that's not what I'm saying.
Dr. But the misrepresentation.
I'm going to just try to... You have to go through the chair here, okay? Dr. Hayes?
The controls that I'm showing here are the men in your factory, not the rural community.
Okay.
The numbers are straight out of your publication. So.
I think I see that distinction.
So they received the same digital exam test that
you know they had on.
Okay. So now we're going to hear from committee members. Representative Sale?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask Dr. Pastor, what is the total sales for the Syngenta company, all products, everything that you sell?
Do you mean what is the size of Syngenta?
Yes, sir.
What is total sales for all products that your company puts in the market?
Syngenta is a very large multinational company that has sales in the neighborhood of about $6 to $8 billion.
All right. What is the sales for this particular... excuse me, Madam Chair. What is the total sale amount worldwide for this chemical?
Mr. Vester?
The worldwide sales are less than 10% of that in gross terms across the world.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some pretty compelling testimony. I have first a question for Dr. Pastor and then a comment. Dr. Pastor, you've testified here that Syngenta is concerned about public health, that you're invested in the business of producing cost-effective food for Americans. In general, we appreciate that. So we have two bills before us, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them or not. House File 1986, one of them...
Excuse me, Representative Moe. We actually have only House File 1986 before us. In your folders is the other House File that we'll be considering on Friday.
Okay, great. Thank you. 1986, one we have before us. Actually, it's just asking our Department of Health to based on the research, and that's what you've talked about here, to set a standard for public consumption. And given your testimony here, I would just assume that you would support that. Am I incorrect in that?
Support the level of...
Just that having our own Minnesota Department of Health, our state agency, review the research, much like you've shown that the Department of our Environmental Protection Agency has done, just to set what the safe drinking water standard is for us in Minnesota.
My understanding is that the Department of Ag and the Department of Health work very closely together. Now, I've not made a close study of this, but I do promote and very much support the idea that there is a free, open exchange of scientific information between those two groups. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but should the Department of Health be involved in making sure that these things are done properly? And I think that is an ongoing process here in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Shumper?
Madam Chair, if I could just clarify a little bit on my bill, because a number of our committee members came in after I had presented my bills initially. House File 1986 does not ban atrazine, okay? None of the four bills that Senator Marty and I have authored ban atrazine. They're all designed to improve and heighten the level of regulatory scrutiny of atrazine in our state. This bill in particular, I feel reassured given Mr. Pasture's comment. It pushes the Department of Health to set the limit at one part per billion. And given Mr. Pasture's comments here, that should be, he just said that the levels of atrazine are declining in the state, well below that. And so if we set that limit, if he's correct, atrazine will continue to be used in this state as it currently is. Of course, by setting it that low, we are able to more effectively take into consideration the health consequences that Dr. Hayes addressed in his presentation. So, please read the bill and don't read things into the bill that aren't in the bill. Okay?
All right. I understand both our witnesses want to respond. I want to just give committee members first a chance to have the questions, and then we'll come back to you.
I just had a follow-up statement.
Oh, sure. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other, just also to comment to your testimony, for us in the state of Minnesota to have complete confidence in the Environmental Protection Agency to protect our environment, I think there are several examples that we've heard in this committee and others where they've eroded that trust considerably. And in particular in my area, Cass Lake, there's a Superfund site that has been in existence since 1984 that is administered by the Environmental Protection Agency, where we have almost 40 families who are currently living on a Superfund site. And the Environmental Protection Agency has gone on and on and on with international paper. These families are still living on a Superfund site, exposed to known levels of dioxin that we know are actually very harmful at the level. So at least with many of us, the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't give us much comfort.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up with Representative Moe's question. Having to do with this particular bill, are you saying, Mr. Pastor, that you do not think the state of Minnesota ought to meet the federal standards?
Mr. Pastor.
Madam Chair, if I understand the question, is should the federal standards be adhered to? And the answer to that is very much that they should be adhered to. The maximum contaminant level is 3 parts per billion. That's a national standard set by the EPA, and that certainly would be a minimum standard for atrazine. But I do want to address, if I could, Mr. Moe's commentary there. I'm here to speak about atrazine in particular and a 12-year process that it went through by EPA to make their decisions. And it was done in a very open and very transparent process that everyone could see all of the data.
Madam Chair, my follow-up question is, again, Mr. Pastor. Thank you, Madam Chair. How would you characterize the European Union's banning of atrazine, its use, including Syngenta's own home country? Was that a mistake on the part of the European Union in your personal and professional opinion?
Yes, Mr.
Madam Chair, it is not banned in the European Union.
Well, you're not allowed to use it there. We know the technical phrase. They do not use it in the European Union, do they?
Let me make 3 points on that. Number one, the reasons why it was not re-registered in the European Union is an arbitrary analytical standard. It has nothing to do with human safety whatsoever. As a matter of fact, the review board from the United Kingdom, which is called the Rapporteur State, actually came back and endorsed the re-registration of atrazine. So those are the major points there. The third point is that there is a companion compound to atrazine, terbutalazine, that is currently registered there. It's almost identical to atrazine itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of showing some ignorance, I do have a question related to the EPA, and I guess I could either spend some time looking it up or just ask the question here in committee. Mr. Hayes, I believe it is, yes?
Yes.
I don't even know if you know the answer to my question, but I'm curious where there's been some discussion about EPA and what they do. The question I had is, do you know where they get their funding from? I mean, I'm sure that this is all this research going on. It's not free. Where does the bulk of the, and maybe anybody can answer this question for me, but Mr. Hayes, I'd like to start with you.
I didn't go into as much of the problems that I've observed with the EPA, but the funding for doing research does not come from the EPA, it comes from the manufacturer. And that in and of itself is problematic because, the European Union just now passed a policy where chemicals have to be proven safe before they can be registered. We have the opposite situation in the United States, where once the chemical's on the market, the company, the manufacturer, is then challenged to prove that it has negative effects. So Syngenta and others, I guess, Syngenta is probably the registrant is the primary source of the funding. That in and of itself generates problems, especially when you've heard about the scientific advisory panel within, weeks? That's a scientific advisory panel that came back and said that we needed more data on atrazine. Within weeks, Syngenta was funding one of the members of that panel. Am I correct? That's not a misrepresentation, correct? Werner Kloos, who was on the scientific advisory panel for the EPA, went on your payroll within weeks. That's the equivalent of if I'm a juror and I come back as a juror and say, well, there's not enough evidence to convict, and then the accused gives me money to find more evidence. So there are a lot of problems inherent with the EPA. And in addition, as I've shown in my talk here, that even if they went through the scientific process, which would take 40 years, if they had that process in 1973, things that we got rid of a long time ago would be back on the market. So the main issue here, bigger than atrazine, is Minnesota and as many other states as I can work in have to send a message to the EPA that you need a different methodology and one that is protective of public health, not protective of the manufacturer.
Is that okay?
Yeah, I've kind of been plugged into this issue because I was really surprised to find out that the problems that we're having in Woodbury and all the studies that are being done are supported by 3M, which is interesting to me, and I think we need to look more into that. Thank you for your answer.
Representative Peterson, McNamara, and then we're going to wind this up here today because we have the session at 11:30.
Mike, just a procedural question. Questions are being asked of Mr. Pastor, and Mr. Hayes is using the visual screen almost in a process of debate. And I would suggest maybe that when Mr. Pastor is asking a question, that the screen is not used as a contradiction during the process.
No.
Just procedurally,
Mr. Sure, no problem. Maybe we can just turn that off.
I just turned.
Great, thank you. Well, Representative McNamara, did you have a question?
Well, this is interesting, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I actually was just going to ask Dr. Hayes if he could go back to a couple of slides.
if you would like that, we'll do that.
Yeah.
Dr. Hayes, is that possible?
I just popped it back on.
Okay. I have a couple of questions, Madam Chair, and Dr. Hayes. And Dr. Pastor, I'll just tell you, if you want to contradict as Dr. Hayes talks, we are all supposed to work through the chair, so if we do that, we'll go a lot better. It is just the decorum that we've learned, and unlike both of you, I don't have a PhD, so we'll work through this. Dr. Hayes, I wanted to go back. You had a slide. On the left, it was headed spring. On the right was a picture of a cornfield with a little bit of water in it. As you go there, my point is to committee members, Madam Chair, and to the audience, that the importance of that picture, Dr. Hayes, I just want to ask you, it's troubling for me to see in that picture, folks, I want you to look at that and see what we're dealing with here. We have no buffer there. We have no protection from row crop right into water. I just want to ask you, Dr. Hayes, is that not troubling to see the soil and the potential erosion of chemical soil and all the different things right into where the frogs are living? I think this picture, and then I wanted to ask you, do you know what, is this picture from the United States?
Yes.
Dr. Hayes?
Yes, this is a picture from the United States. It's one of our sites in Nebraska. And the irony is, that you're pointing out, is this is very common in Nebraska because a lot of the protected areas for wildlife, which are primarily funded by duck hunters, are in cornfields for that reason, because I guess the corn attracts. I'm not a hunter personally, but this is the situation that you often find in Nebraska and in the Midwestern general.
Madam Chair, and then a follow-up. Dr. Hayes, if you could go to the slide that was even more troubling for me, the one in Uganda. And I'll just make the same point if you can flip back to it. This is a case, and I was curious, what is the crop, the agricultural crop there?
They're primarily in Uganda, the primary crops are corn or maize, but it's a much bigger variety. We use kernels and arrowroot. And arrowroot has to be grown in water.
Okay. Madam Chair, Dr. Hayes, what's the crop in the photo?
That one, I believe, was arrowroot in this particular crop.
There's
corn just to the left.
I just want folks to know, these are some of the issues that we absolutely, and our agriculture committee needs to deal with on how we need to protect the waters better for all the reasons. I don't really want to get into all the differences, but I do want to take one thing. Dr. Hayes, myself and Representative Schumper are, I think, probably the only two committee members that have made at least part of our living in the agricultural community. And I've got a business partner that I've been associated with for 30 years, and I want to know, when you talk about people handling atrazine being 24,000 times more susceptible to infertility, was that workers with the standards that we have in Minnesota for the worker protection? I think of my business partner in the suit he puts on, and he climbs into this tractor. I want to know, because I was led to believe by your slide that he's 24,000 times more applicable to have whatever it was than I, who has never done that spraying. Is that what you were saying, or was this something not true as in Minnesota?
Dr. Hayes?
Let me go back and make clear. The original data set would show the 0.1 or 0.14 parts per billion in the urine. That was associated with subfertility in men. But those weren't agricultural workers. Those were just men who live in an agricultural area. The next set of data showed where urine levels went up to 240, and the next one where they went up to 2400. Those were agricultural workers. And I wanted to make a point about, even if you can get water below one part per billion, even if, for example, you can afford a water filter and bottled water, the primary people that we're talking about with the 240 and 24,000 times the level that causes problems, one, might not have access, but two, even if they do, that was primarily dermal exposure.
Madam Chair, Dr. Hayes, I only have 4 years of college. I don't have seven or eight as you and Dr. Pastor.
Yeah, I've been in school since I was five.
My business partner wearing the equipment I talked about, one of those that you had on that screen.
I don't know in that particular.
In
that particular study, I don't know if they reported what type of equipment was being worn, but they did use a methodology that showed that most of the atrazine was across the skin, in 95% of it. So even if it was out of the water, men working in that area would still have that type of exposure. But again, I don't know the equipment that was used in that particular paper. I can look on that and get back to you.
That was a methamer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hayes, maybe I'll ask you your opinion then. My business partner that puts this white suit on, covered head to toe and with some kind of a fancy-looking respirator, is he going to be susceptible to 24,000 times? That's what's required in Minnesota. And I want to know, this bill we're discussing is in Minnesota. And is the data you were talking about agricultural field workers from a different country? I just think it's important. Are these the ag field workers that we've got in our nursery that my son now owns now? Is that what you're saying? These folks are susceptible to that even though they're not handling this chemical? I'm just trying to understand what you presented there. It's scaring the socks out of me if you're telling me my business partner wearing this kind of equipment, and I don't seem to get you to answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hayes?
The most direct answer is I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because that study was done. I'll have to look at what state, but it was in the United States where that study was done, and they were following whatever rules it was in the state that it was done, but I don't know how that compares to what Minnesota is required. I hope that's clear. So in that particular study, they were following the regulations that they used for that state. I don't think there are nationwide rules for how you have to wear protective equipment. But I can look, what I'm saying to you is I can look into that paper and figure out what state it is, and then hopefully we can figure out how that compares to Minnesota. But I don't know what the regulations are from state to state in that regard.
One final question.
Well, Madam Chair, Dr. Hayes, are you trying to tell me that my business partner wearing the white protective clothing, whatever that's Tyvek or whatever that stuff is, that he has to constantly throw away, even though I say it looks brand new? He says, no, this is, there's a certain life to this. We've got to throw it away. We've got to change the filter each. I don't know all that stuff. But I just know that he's going through a lot of precautions. And I want to, is it for naught? Are you telling me none of that stuff works?
That's what... The study indicates that you are correct, that it doesn't work. Because those are the levels that applicators have, and those are the levels that field workers have in that particular state following their regulations.
Okay,
how those regulations compare to Minnesota, I can find out. I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Members, we need to conclude the questions of our witnesses. You can both step away from the table, and I'm going to ask Representative Schumper to conclude his comments. We are going to vote on this. Do you have a final comment?
Yes, I do.
Okay, one final comment, then I'll ask you both to step away, and we're going to vote in this committee on this bill.
Madam Chair, thank you for this last thing. I won't take but a second here.
Excuse me, I just were laying it over. That's right. Sorry.
Mr. Krantz's point about funding and the types of data that are provided. I just wanted to make a point here that in Ann Lindsay's testimony, and indeed in the procedures that EPA has to adhere to, everything has to be wide open and available to anyone. And this being tax time, the best analogy I can make to this is that, can you imagine yourself being audited on your taxes every year with every scrap of paper being produced? That's what we have to live by. Dr. Hayes does not. And in fact, Dr. Lindsay even mentioned that she says that Dr. Hayes claims not only that his laboratory has repeated his findings many times in experiments with thousands of frogs, but that other scientists have also replicated his results. EPA, however, has never seen either the results from the independent investigators published in peer-reviewed scientific journals or the raw data from Dr. Hayes' additional experiments. So transparency is what we're held to. It's like an IRS audit that we have to live by. And that should give you some confidence no matter where the funding comes from.
Okay.
I'll be quick. No problem.
Okay. I'm going to one response back from Dr. Hayes, and then I'm going to ask you two to step back. We, as a committee, we need to... determined that Representative McFarland had a question that I'm going to honor because she had her hand up a few minutes ago and I missed it. Dr. Hayes?
Two quick points. One, that statement that wasn't true. In fact, I produced and made available to you in the past other statements by Tom Steger, the EPA, thanking me for all of my raw data and et cetera. So that statement wasn't true. But two, what I want to point out is if you think about my presentation, it's not about whether or not Tyrone's data is correct. It's not just about frogs. There's all the frog data that was done, not in my laboratory. There's the fish data. There's the rat data that's been done in laboratories from Europe and you name it. There's the human data, the human cell line data, which has been done in Japan and Europe. The frog data, my data, as important as I think it is one small part of the problem.
Okay.
So let's not focus on Tyrone.
Okay.
At all.
I'm going to ask you two just to step back now. Committee needs to make a decision here in a few minutes. We're going to lay this over. I think there was a question from...
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, is the Department of Health, do they have anything to say about this bill?
Representative Shumper, you have had a conversation with the Department of Health.
Yes, I did. Mr. Stein, and I conferred about this yesterday and this morning, and I originally had somewhat of a different bill, and you may have seen that, and so I modified it pretty much along the lines that Mr. Stein suggested and we discussed.
Mr. Stein, welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Lane Stein, Director for Environmental Health at Minnesota Department of Health. Representative Shumper is correct. We spoke yesterday and again this morning. The language of the bill is a directive to the department in Section 1A to establish a drinking water standard or health risk limit for private wells. That's technically groundwater that's a source. And so some of the language here is somewhat could use some improvement. We'll work with Representative Shumper to continue to work towards sort of clarifying the language. But it directs the department to establish a health risk limit, which we have not... formally seen the language until this morning, so I'm just responding to what I've seen right here. The department would be in a position to implement something similar to that. I don't know yet because we haven't looked at how we would implement that or how long it would be effective under the law.
Okay.
The second section of the bill is we would be interested in working with Representative Shumper to clarify some of the language there, but again, I think that what it's saying to me is that the level is being established not to exceed one part per billion. And I think I'd like to have some conversation with the committee at another time about the assumptions behind that.
Any members? Session starts in about 5 minutes of concluding statement from Representative Shumper, and then this bill will be laid over.
Two, I just want to clarify to the committee from Part A in the bill that currently the health risk limit for private wells is 20 parts per billion. Now, Mr. Stein informed me yesterday that they, whenever they're having discussions with people, they're saying that they should be around 3 parts per billion. But the current level set in statute is, or great, in regulations, is 20 parts per billion. So we're bringing that down to be the same as the maximum containment level for public water systems in this bill. Secondly, I want to respond to Representative Grant's concerns about the review of scientific literature. For those of you who don't have a background in the natural sciences, and I do, that's where I have my undergraduate degree, the golden rule, the gold standard in scientific research is peer group review. I spent the last several days looking through peer group journals, and I can tell you they are full. They are literally full of publications from Dr. Hayes on the full array of research that he talked about here today. Believe me, it's tremendous. I almost thought, and you know, I didn't know what to present to this committee because, you know, I could have a stack of stuff 3 feet high of peer group journals, peer group articles, peer reviewed articles that have appeared in these journals from Dr. Hayes and his colleagues. The most important of which is one just published in February from a group in Japan where Dr. Hayes assisted as a corresponding author that established a link between human cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, and atrazine use. That just came out in February 2007. So I appreciate your support for the bill. This is a big step forward in dealing with this problem. Believe me, we're going to be proud of ourselves 10 years from now that we did this.
Madam Chair.
Okay, without Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion that we amend Representative Chumper's motion that this bill be recommended to move to the Ag Finance Committee. We have not heard from Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, any of the environmental community. None of them have been able to speak to this bill. We haven't heard from the Department of Ag, the MPCA. All this current regulation is under the Department of Ag. We are moving this to the Department of Health. We do not have a fiscal note. We don't know what the cost is to the Department of Health. or if the Department of Ag is supportive of this. This is important stuff, folks. We need this to go to the Ag Finance Committee so Representative Junkie's committee can hear from all these folks. This is important stuff. We need to hear this. Madam Chair, I want to amend the motion that we move it to the Ag Finance Committee. I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Okay. Representative McNamara moves to amend Representative Shumper's motion. Representative Shumper.
I'm opposed to that. We have three other bills that take up atrazine, and any of those could be referred possibly to the Ag Committee. This bill deals specifically with the health-related aspects of atrazine. Chairman Clark and I have discussed this, and I see no value in sending it to the Ag Committee.
Representative McNamara, let me just weigh in on this as well. We do have another bill that will be considered on Friday, and that bill will be referred. It's a bill dealing with atrazine. It will be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. This bill deals with the Department of Ag, and I support, the Department of Health, and I support Representative Shumper's motion, and I would ask committee members to do so. We're going to take a roll call.
Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara.
This deals with Representative Shumper. You're a dairy farmer.
Yes, I am.
This deals with atrazine. Atrazine is used in the vast majority of our agricultural land, and this health committee is going to make a recommendation to lay this over for possible inclusion, and we are not going to let the public know about this important process through our ag committee that Chair Junkie chairs. And I understand that you're saying you have other bills. This bill is an important bill that deserves the ag committee. We are not the ag committee, and I was wrong. It's not only you and I. Representative Eastland also milked cows for a number of years, and we know how important it is that the Ag Committee and all their different interests get to weigh in on this, and I don't appreciate us trying to hide this process. This is not right. We heard some important testimony, and this is wrong to squish this and lay this over. We should have an open process that allows this to move to the Ag Committee, Madam Chair. Absolutely.
I understand your position. The clerk will take the roll.
Can you repeat again what we're voting yes or no on?
This is the amendment by Representative McNamara to the motion by Representative Shumper. So we're voting on Representative McNamara's amendment to refer this to the Ag Committee.
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Eastland?
Yes.
Representative Huntley?
No.
Representative Kranz?
No.
Representative Lane?
No.
Representative Medora?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Representative Moe?
No.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Severson?
Yes.
Representative Swales?
No.
Representative Shumper?
No.
Because 6-10, the motion fails. The bill is laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned. The meeting is adjourned.